Welcome to this week's Current Federal Tax Developments, brought to you by Kaplan Professional Education and your State Society of CPAs. This week, we're going to be looking at some developments that have occurred. Interestingly enough, the big things have occurred in instructions and forms. I'm Ed Zollers from Phoenix, and we're going to look at a few things before we get to the forms and instructions. First, the IRS fixed a troublesome problem that was created when the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act went to 100% bonus depreciation with regard to what we all refer to as the luxury auto rules. We'll take a look at a private letter ruling that allowed a sub-trust to qualify as a conduit trust for IRA distribution purposes. The AICPA this week sent out a letter to the IRS asking for some regulatory changes that would fix a problem we discussed last month regarding the problem of the syndicate rules and the potential that has for taking away a number of potential tax benefits from small businesses. Then we'll get to our forms and instructions problem. First, we'll talk about the Form 1065 instructions that now require certain partnerships that were not reporting tax basis on Schedule K-1 for the partners to report that information if the tax basis number would be zero. And secondly, we're going to talk about not so much a new thing, it's something that's been true on S corporations for a number of years, but something that is now been added. A new box has been added to Schedule E if you're required to attach a basis computation. And the IRS then recently updated the instructions for Schedule E. And they added more requirements, for cases where you're going to have to attach that basis computation. So we'll talk about how that goes. Well, as you're probably all aware, this is the week when the brokers had to get their 1099 consolidated 1099s out. That doesn't mean we won't have changes on them, but it does mean that probably you're finding a lot more of your clients now have everything ready to go, and they're going to be starting tax season for real now. So we're getting into the mode of it's tax season time. Does mean that, I'm not going to be doing any more, CPE courses. I don't believe I will until tax season ends. There are still a few, those of you who are in the various states, there are some courses being offered. I know New Jersey is going to offer a couple of hour and a half sessions related on Section 199 Cap A, because that's still a big deal. But to a large extent, the CPE season is finished now that we're into major time frame, the 2 months run to April 15th. And so hopefully you're all ready for that. But IRS and things don't start happening with the IRS, I should say, just because we're in tax season. And we have a few developments this week. The first one is kind of a welcome development. This is Revenue Procedure 2019-13. This was issued on February 13th. And this one deals with a quirk we have due to the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act and going to 100% bonus depreciation. Generally, that's a good thing. But as you're all aware, we have this rule in Section 280F, which we have all, I think, called, informally the luxury auto rule. And we know it's not really luxury autos. But remember, we have limitations on how much you can claim for depreciation or Section 179 expenses if you have an automobile, a passenger auto. And generally, under the bonus depreciation rules, we're capped at $18,000 as the maximum amount for the first year depreciation. Why is there a problem with what they did with the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act? Well, here's our problem. Under the rules of 280F, if you go back, you remember them, you take a look at them. Generally, what happens is we compute our depreciation like normal. Any depreciation that's disallowed in a year from what it would have been normally as a five-year maker's depreciation is held back, and then we begin to use that up after we get past the end of the recovery period. So generally in year seven, because it takes us basically 6 years, remember half year convention the first year, half year last year. So that means a five-year asset has 6 years on the schedule. Well, that means that basically in year seven, we pick up whatever is left over. Now the problem, remember, a standard five-year asset with bonus depreciation would have 100% of its cost recovered the first year. That means the entire cost in excess of $18,000 would suddenly become in that disallowed category that would drift all the way back to year number seven. before we would start picking it up and writing it off. Well, that seems somewhat, shall we say, counterintuitive. Certainly, it doesn't seem like that was what Congress intended by increasing bonus depreciation. To be totally honest, this has always been the issue. You know, as they increase bonus depreciation, this amount thrown to the back got higher. But now it's ridiculous, because if you look at it, and if you download the article that I wrote and I put on the website, and you download the PDF we have of this, you're going to see that, you know, we take $18,000, we got a $60,000 car, let's say. We take $18,000 depreciation on 2018 return. That's fine. But then 2019 through 2023, we take no depreciation on the car. And then we begin depreciating the car at $5,760 per year beginning in 2024. Why $5,760? Because that's the ending number, the max per year. And that's the number we use to start recovering once we get to the end of the recovery period. So this car stays around all the way till 2031 before it is fully depreciated. So this car is going to be hanging around, shall we say, for 13 years on the depreciation schedule. Probably that means that realistically for a lot of our clients and for most cars, the $18,000 will be the only depreciation you ever get. That's not quite what we wanted. So now we're going to go ahead and do it just a little differently. So the IRS is providing a safe harbor that allows us to recover depreciation, and our recovery is going to be based on that excess amount, that $42,000 in this example, right, that was not depreciated. We're going to take that $42,000 and treat that as if it was the original cost. We're then going to multiply that by the standard maker's factors for years 2 through 6, those percentages. Take the lesser of that depreciation or the limitations that we have for the year. And remember, this year, our limitations on depreciation for those placed in service this year is $9,600 for year 2, $5,760 for all remaining years. So we take the lesser of those two. Then finally, when we get to the end, that's when we start recovering whatever is left over. Okay. Now, in order to use this, there are a few requirements. First thing is, well, the asset must be acquired and placed in service by the taxpayer after September 27th, 2017. Oh, yeah, should remind you, if they bought this car at the last part of 18, this problem is showing up this year in your pro formas for your tax software. Until your tax software corrects this problem, you may want to double check how it's computing, because it certainly is not computing this way, I would expect. So you ought to be very careful for those cars acquired late last year that got the $18,000. But let's continue. So first, of course, placed in service after September 27, 2017. It's property for which 100% additional first-year depreciation deduction is allowable. It has an unadjusted depreciable basis exceeding the first-year limitation. So we're going to have a disallowance. Yeah, you buy a car that's only $15,000. Yeah, we're going to get the whole thing year one. But that's not where our problem is. And finally, you cannot claim a 179 expense for the car. Arguably, you probably shouldn't be claiming it, I would guess. Generally, bonus will get you to the whole thing. But I assume maybe somebody wants to use 179 because, you know, they're trying to tune in their taxable income. Remember, you can do a partial election of 179. It still gets a little quirky, but assuming all that works, you could do that, do a partial 179 for $18,000. Leave the remainder to be depreciated, that would effectively get you the same result, because what will happen is you have $42,000 left over. None of that will be allowed as depreciation, right? We're getting depreciation on that. So effectively, well, not quite the same. Mechanically, we're probably going to lose still that first year. Yeah, it's just messy. We're just going to say it's going to be kind of bad. So whatever we lose, that first year comes a second. So here's the catch. We go ahead and we use our maker's tables and use our annual limitation. So if I do that, let's go back to my $60,000 vehicle. In year two, my percentage is 32%. 32% of $42,000 is $13,440, right? So basically, we'd say that'd be the first year, I'd say. Year two, 19.2%. Well, that's in essence going to be less, in this case, the $42,000. So we're going to get for that 8064, right? We'll get 4838, the other years, et cetera, 2419, 2023. Then in 2024, 2025, we'll end up picking up our remainder. So basically, we're going to get depreciation all through this, and the car will be fully depreciated by 2025, a much nicer result. Again, thing to remember is those end-of-year 17 cars that are pro-forma'd, your tax software almost certainly is doing that depreciation wrong at this moment. Do you want to make sure you pick that up and correct that, or wait for your tax software to catch up with this revenue procedure, which may take a while? So we'll have that going on. But it does mean that we have good news regarding purchases of cars. Next development. I'm going to take a look at a private letter ruling here. Private letter ruling 2019-02-23 issued on February the 8th. This is taking a look at the issue of when you leave an IRA to a trust. In this particular case, the trust is one. And what happened in this case, we have a single trust. The trust provided that essentially when the gentleman died, it was revocable living trust. When this person died, gentleman, woman, not quite sure, you know, whoever, when this individual died, that trust, you know, the fund, the IRA funds were payable to the trust, but the trust established a sub-trust to hold the benefits and distributions from any retirement plan. And, you know, these trusts and the sub-trust valid under the laws of the state, decedent dies. The question is, can we use the sub-trust? Well, the terms of the trust governing that sub-trust provide that all property held by that trust will be held, administered, and distributed for the benefit of a beneficiary, right? The trust document states the beneficiary shall be the sole beneficiary. All retirement benefits distributed to the trustee, including the RMD, will be paid directly to the beneficiary as soon as the trust gets it. So it'll be a conduit trust, right? It also states that the beneficiary's death, any qualified retirement plans or account, including remaining assets of the sub-trust, shall be divided equally between and distributed to the decedent's children or their descendants. Question was, can we use this? What we want to do is be able to use this to look through the trust, through the sub-trust, grab the beneficiary as our designated beneficiary, and use their life expectancy for our distributions, preferably getting a much longer stretch out than we're going to get if we can't. So the IRA goes to this trust. The IRS ruled in this case that, yeah, that this qualifies. The amounts have to flow through. Remember, we have this conduit. It has to flow through. The conduit could use the beneficiary's life expectancy. Sometimes you'll see actually, you know, a totally separate trust document written and the trust and basically the benefit assigned to that. But this says, yeah, we can have it all in one document as long as, and that document then can throw off a trust, which obviously won't instantly appear, but can throw off the trust. Now, the standard rules, you have to deliver a copy of the trust or information about the trust to the IRA custodian. I always find that a fun rule because nothing tells a custodian what to do with it. So sometimes you have an extra explanation when you try to give that to somebody at the brokerage firm or the bank. We have to make sure everything goes to the beneficiary, right, during their lifetime, and it comes directly out to that. But if we meet all those requirements, we can do it. It is an option. The advantage of using the trust, basically the advantage of using a trust very simply, is that we can assure that only the RMDs come out. We can control how much money comes out because the beneficiary doesn't get direct touch on it. The trustee controls that. And we can control where it goes if the beneficiary dies before the balance of the IRA is completely paid out. This, the actual use of this trust for look through, you'll find it in Regulation 1.409A9-4, and it's in question and answer number 5. So you want to find out, do that. By the way, for those of you, if you do work this, the obvious book that most people use is Natalie Choate's Life and Death Planning Retirement Benefits. Hopefully I got the name right. You can find that at ataxplan.com is where she does it. I know that there's now just recently been a brand new revision of that one done. I mention that book only because every time I've been in any session that anybody has ever discussed retirement benefits and trusts. In fact, just recently I had that. I saw that at Arizona's tax conferences are called this year. You know, her book gets mentioned. She's been writing this ever since. I think it goes all the way back to before the current regulations went final. So that's the book for using it. And again, you got to have enough money. You got to have two things to make sense for this. Number one, there's got to be enough money in the trust, enough money in the IRA to make it worthwhile to set up a trust. Then number two, you also have to have a situation where we want to do a stretch out. If we're not really trying to stretch out the distributions, again, the trust probably doesn't make sense to fund to spend the money to try to fund the trust. But when it works, the trust is a really, really useful device. So if you haven't thought about that, your clients haven't considered it, you might want to consider that, especially if you're trying to stretch out an IRA or a Roth IRA over a long period of time. Next up, this isn't really an IRS development, but it's the AICPA sent a letter this week to the Internal Revenue Service asking for the agency to modify the regulations in order to help assure that small businesses don't lose some of the benefits that the Congress intended them to receive because they get picked up by this category called syndicates. For those who don't remember, we discussed this back in January, just about a month ago. We discussed this issue. This issue is, remember, it is related to the definition of tax shelters. And we walked you through the three definitions of what a tax shelter is. And the big problem one we may have is this thing called a syndicate. The issue is, if you are a tax shelter, all of these things in the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act that are tied to your revenue being below $25 million, that includes things like being on the cash basis of accounting, that includes things like getting out of 263 Cap A unit cap rules, have the special rules for inventory under 471, we can ignore 471A and use the secondary options, and maybe very significantly, not being subject to the 163J interest limits. If you think the 199 Cap A rules are complicated, you haven't taken a look at the regulations under 163J. So if you can avoid 163J, you certainly want to avoid it. But all of those aren't available to you if you are a tax shelter under Section 448. And as we discussed last month, you can go back and listen to that broadcast if you haven't been through this before, and I won't repeat everything here. But the real problem we have is this concept of a thing called a syndicate. A syndicate, one of the three tax shelters that they list, a syndicate exists whenever you have 35% or more of the losses are allocable, according to the code, allocated according to the regulations, to limited entrepreneurs. Limited entrepreneurs are individuals who are not limited partners, but who do not materially participate in the management of the enterprise. So for instance, LLC members who are not managers would, at least at first glance, appear to be at high risk of being limited entrepreneurs. Because, you know, if all they did was put up the money, you know, and they don't do day-to-day management, they're not involved in day-to-day management, you know, they have limited rights in that realm, they were simply investing in. Well, we get limited entrepreneurs, which means that if a business lost money in a year, we would have losses allocated. If they hold more than 35% of the interest, well, yeah, all of those benefits come tumbling down. We lose them all in that year. And again, the IRS has made it very clear they're not going to let us swap in and out of the special accounting method rules, the cash basis, the 263 Cap A, and the rules under the inventory, I should say, and also, don't forget the small contractor exception. But also 163J, we can come in and out of that, but that's going to create a nightmarish situation and also creates a bit of a circular problem because conceivably, if the interest rules apply, we won't have a loss because we can't deduct the interest. But therefore now we're not a syndicate, but as soon as we say we're not, then we allocate and suddenly we are a syndicate. So, okay, there's all kinds of problems involved with the syndicate rules. So the AICPA is suggesting that the IRS issue regulations under the authority they have, and the authority they're going for is found in section 1256E3C5, or Roman numeral 5. And the issue is, now you might wonder, how do we get there? You know, this is under 448, and we're talking about rules in other sections. There are cross-references eventually take you to 1256. And 1256 allows the IRS to write regs that can treat certain interests as not being treated as inactive if the IRS determines by regulations or otherwise that that interest being held by an individual should be treated as if it was held by an individual who actually participates. What the IRS is suggesting is, or I should say the AICPA is suggesting the IRS, is they issue a regulation under that rule that says, if you meet the following conditions, you'll be treated as materially participating under that special rule. First, they say, if the entity qualifies under the gross receipts test, $25 million. Number two, it otherwise meets the definition of a syndicate. But number three, you know, It does not qualify, number three, it does not qualify to elect out of 163J, being a real property trader business, or to be under elect out under the electing farm business. Okay. Basically, if it can meet those three requirements, then if it wants to, you know, then basically we'll treat these people as materially participating. Now, why would we want to do that? You know, obviously we want to be able to take advantage of these benefits. Now, it's interesting, and we'll have to see. First thing is, please remember, this is just the AICPA suggesting. Secondly, you got to wonder about the two, about saying, yeah, well, if they got real estate or farming, they have an out. It's, you never quite know how these things happen, but I wouldn't be surprised that in some conversations with the IRS, they may have gotten the feeling that the IRS is not going to be willing to write those out of the category. They're going to expect them to take the ADS depreciation hit if they're in there, which could be a problem even with the AICPA suggested issue. If you've not looked at the syndicate issue, like I said, we talked about it fairly extensively in a podcast about a month ago. You can go back on our channel and, you know, find that. Go back in your podcast list. You should find that one. Talks about syndicates. Take a look at that. But also keep your eye on this. Hopefully the IRS will give us some sort of relief. They have in the past tried to keep the syndicate rule from, you know, kind of accidentally falling on people in the other areas it applies. We're going to cross our fingers that they might do the same thing here. Next, we have information from instructions and forms. Now, you and I both know, you know, we're talking about the tax laws here. We go through the code, we go through regs, we're looking at revenue rulings, we're looking at all kinds of these things. And quite often, let's be honest, every year they print the instructions to the forms. And for instance, the instructions to forms 1065 is 60 pages long, three columns, not really big print, right? And so it's very tempting to ignore that whole instruction book and just, you know, go ahead and prepare the returns. It's like, because you know that 98% of what's in there is going to be word for word identical to what it was last year and the year before and year before. Well, this year turns out there are a couple of things that are important in the changes. And one of the key problems we run into is that if you don't do this, there is a penalty consequence that can be significant. We'll talk about that here in just a second. So what we're going to look at here are the instructions to Form 1065 that were released in final form by the IRS on February the 4th of 2019. Now, what happened in this case, when they issued it, we had a couple of things happen, okay? The IRS wants information on any partners that have a negative tax basis capital. The reason they want this is because, let's say, you know, what it means is the taxpayer is relying upon borrowed funds to be able to claim either losses or distributions without paying tax currently. In such situations, generally at some point, this is going to reverse and they're going to end up picking up income at some point down the line. Most of us probably, you know, in small CPA firms, we're mainly using tax basis capital accounts on the Schedule K-1. And the good news is, this particular change in the instructions will not affect those taxpayers at all. But a lot of times, especially with more complex partnerships, with partnerships that are issuing financial statements, with partnerships with larger CPA firms, we often see used either the 704B capital accounts, because the theory of that being we got to keep those anyway. So we'll use 704B and report that on the Schedule K-1, or we'll just use the GAAP financial statements because we're reporting on the GAAP basis. We got a GAAP financial, we're doing an audit or review. And so we're already doing that work. So we just put that on there as our number, knowing that, hey, anyway, tax basis capital isn't necessarily the partner's tax basis. So no real advantage doing that, we thought. So we're doing GAAP statements. Well, this is where the problem comes in. This year, if you're doing either one of those, you have to put a disclosure on Schedule K-1. In fact, what you're going to find here is there actually is a new code, Schedule Code AH, that goes on line 20 of Schedule K-1. And you're going to have to do, it lists such partners' beginning and ending shares of tax basis capital. So if Schedule K-1 is not tax basis, and if the capital account is negative, right, either beginning end of year, right? So what we have, you know, we have to report that on Schedule K-1 using the special new code AH. The problem we went into with that is if you fail to do it, that is treated under 6698A2 as an incomplete, return a report which fails to show the information required. That is penalized at $195 per month per partner. Now, this was pointed out in an article in Tax Analyst this week. Tax Notes Today is where I saw it. It was also, there was a Bloomberg tax piece on it as well. The thing to note about this, this is a potential nasty penalty. It does not qualify for first-time abatement. Late filing, which is a penalty triggered by 6698A1, does qualify for first-time abatement. This one doesn't. If you do have a problem with this, though, they do point out that the Internal Revenue Manual does provide that if they do have an incomplete filing, they are supposed to be given the ability to give that information before the IRS assesses the penalty. But the bottom line is, you need to know what tax basis capital is, even if you're filing, you know, you're actually doing, let's say, a GAAP financial statement, and you're doing 704B capital. So if you're in a firm where, you know, you've got a partnership that is reporting that way, be aware you're going to have to develop the tax basis capital numbers. That also means for practical purposes, almost all partnerships are going to need to keep two sets of partners' capital. Because you always, you know, assuming the partnership is going to claim that there is substantial economic effect to the allocations in the agreement and use that to be able to support their special allocations to keep the IRS from changing them, then we need to maintain the 704B capital accounts, those 704B capital accounts. And now, because of this disclosure, you also need to maintain tax basis capital accounts. And hey, you know what? If they have an audited financial statement under GAAP, you're going to be doing GAAP financial or partners capital accounts. So lots of schedules to work with now. Just lots of this neat stuff coming up. And yes, we need to worry about it because, yes, it has to be disclosed. And no, you can't ignore it because, as I said, it's $195 per month. If you don't provide that, you know, you will get a chance to provide it. The IRS may ask you for it. But if you just say, no, there's no reason you don't need that, it's like now you get penalized. And again, at $195 per month with very many partners, it gets expensive real fast. Now, on to our next change. This one, now we did partnerships. Now we're going to go on to, I love when the IRS posts things on websites these days, they've given up on actually giving headlines. It makes that, you know, that are like headlines for an article. This article is titled Clarification on Line 28, Column E of Schedule E Form 1040. It's an article posted to the IRS website on February the 6th. And what's happening here is the IRS is actually expanding something that's been true for a while, but it was buried in the instructions. Remember, we just talked about instructions for the Form 1065. Well, this is buried in the instructions for the 1120S, but it's been there for quite a while. Generally, I shouldn't say 1120S, but Schedule E. If you read your Schedule E instructions for like the past decade plus, you've always been required to attach a basis schedule to the Form 1040 for a taxpayer who has an interest in an S corporation for any year when the S corporation shows a loss they're claiming on the return. And what the IRS did this year, first, they did two steps. Part of the step showed up when the IRS published the revised Schedule E this year. If you've not looked at page 2 of Schedule E, you're going to find out that they added something there. There is a checkbox on Schedule E that deals with the question. They're going to ask you, check this box if the taxpayer is required to attach a basis computation. That's the issue here for those S Corp shareholders. That schedule, if you're watching the video version I put up on the screen, you know, page 2 and a nice big arrow pointing to it, that E, check if basis computation is required. You are required to check that, and if it is required, you're also required to attach that schedule. Your tax software probably is going to check that box immediately if it's aware that any of the conditions apply, because you're supposed to do a basis computation. That probably also means, though, your software is going to very likely stop you from filing unless you actually give it that basis computation that it can attach to the return. That's going to be like a PDF attachment. A lot of our software has been doing that. I know I use CCH ProSystem FX. ProSystem FX has been, you know, as always, if you input the basis information, they had always been attaching that. And technically, as I said, if there was a loss for the S Corp, they had to attach it. They attached it regardless. They also attached it for partnerships. Not a bad idea all around. But now for S Corps, it's mandatory. And the IRS, what happened here, though, is on this particular clarification, the IRS expanded, so no longer. In the actual instructions, all they say in the Schedule E instructions is, if you're claiming deduction for your share of an aggregate loss, check the box and attach a computation of the adjusted basis of your corporate stock and of any debt the corporation owes you. Okay. Well, this clarification, I love it, means, yeah, we rethought about that. We think we want to know it in more cases. Now the clarification, which again, information on this is found in the PDF. If you download that for this today's podcast, or if you go to our website, currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com, and find the article there that relates to this clarification, what happens here is we have to do it if you report a loss, that's fine, but also if you receive any distribution, if you dispose of your stock, or if you receive any loan repayment during the year from the S Corporation. If any of those are true, you have to attach the basis computation to the Form 1040. So again, another of these things you need to pick up. Remember, again, if you don't attach that, we're back to an incomplete return and all kinds of potential problems from an incomplete return. And probably you're also going to find, I've heard reports from some people, that in any event, their software is just preventing the electronic filing until you put this thing in. So be ready for it. Oh, well, we're underway in tax season. So now you get to apply what you've learned in continuing education this year. We're hoping that if you attended any of our courses here at Kaplan Professional Education, Kaplan State Accounting Continuing Education, part of Kaplan Professional Education, hopefully that you've got something now. And if it's in the tax area, which is where I'm talking about, or it's in the A&A area where we have we have instructors in that area as well, hopefully you're now being able to actually put this stuff to use. You've got revenue recognition to play with coming up. You're going to have the leases on the A&A side, but you also have all the fun stuff from the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. Now is the time to do it. I will remind you that the CP season will start again right after April 15th. We've got some things going on then in May, and even I've got one going on in April. We'll have stuff running there. So we'll be able to get back to it then. But right now, yeah, it's put the pencil to paper, or these days, you know, put the fingers to the keyboard and start entering stuff in to get all the tax stuff taken care of. And hopefully you've now learned what you need to learn to be able to apply the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act this year, because now's the time we really get to do it. As always, you can catch our updates online at the currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com website. If you want to send any comments to me or questions, my email address, edzollers@currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. My Twitter handle, @edzollers. I do post there whenever anything goes up on the website. Also interact with the group there. There's a group that, you know, a number of us that discuss various odd tax issues. So it's a technical tax conversation, but we do carry it on various odd questions. And yes, 199 Cap A has dominated those discussions, as it dominates everywhere else. We also have discussion groups I follow. I follow the Reddit group /r/taxpros right on there at reddit.com. I also follow the Connect groups for the Arizona, New Jersey, and Minnesota State Societies of CPAs. Every so often, I look in on California's Tax Talk. If you want to post questions there, A, you've got a good chance somebody else will chime in too and help answer it. And B, if I get a chance, I'll try to chime in and work there as well. Well, as I say, the return should be coming in pretty quickly at this point. We should be getting stuff in. So I hope you all are ready and well rested going in. And keep, you know, pay attention. We're going to watch what happens this week. And I should be back here next week, and we'll talk about whatever's going on in the following week in the area of current federal tax developments.